The science reporter Lulu Miller, co-creator of the podcast Invisibilia, had this obsession with David Starr Jordan. She first heard about him in her early 20s. He was a taxonomist, first president of Stanford, and he lost his life's work in the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And the story just fascinated her. She couldn't let it go. In fact, it took hold of her for like 10 years. That's how long it took her to write a book about Jordan, but it's also a memoir about her own life. And in the book, she pinpoints the moment that would, as she puts it, pave the way for her obsession.
I'm about 7 years old, standing on the deck of my parents' house in Cape Cod in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. It overlooks this huge marsh. And my dad and I are out on the deck. He's wearing just jean cutoff shorts, and he's got this like big kind of friendly belly with fuzzy hair. And there was high drama. There was a white spot far away in the reeds. So we have the binoculars out, and we're trying to figure out, like, is that like a canoer or a raft or a swan or a buoy? What is that? And I start wondering, like, what's on the other side? These bigger questions start gurgling up. What are we doing here? How big is the earth? What's the point? And so I turned back up to my dad, who was sort of the big main moral authority in my life. And I said, oh, hey, Dad, what's the meaning of life? And he looked at me. He took a moment. And then he turned and he was like, nothing. Nothing. There's no meaning to life. No point. There's no purpose. There's no God. There's no plan. There's no afterlife. And don't believe anyone who tells you there is. Those are all things people tell themselves to comfort themselves against the fact that life is meaningless and pointless. But the truth is, life is meaningless and pointless. From the point of view of the planet, you're no more significant than an ant. And then he paused and was like, although, do I see you aerating the soil or speeding up the decomposition of timber, as ants do? No. So then you're less significant to the planet than an ant. He was just giddy that I'd finally asked so that we could go there, which isn't to say that he doesn't love wonder, but he was eager to share the way that he brewed it, which was through this brand of atheism and nihilism. It was this gorgeous summery morning, and the pines are kind of tipping, and there's some birds around, and just, I remember it just suddenly felt so cold. It was like, well, then what are we all doing here? Why do I go to nursery school? Why does everyone go to their jobs? We're just marching off a plank. That moment, coupled with many, many more moments like that in my childhood, being met with this like aggressive, joyful, dogmatic nihilism and atheism, formed a certain hunger for meaning that I've always been kind of fighting against, shaped me in a certain way.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lulu Miller is joining us today to talk about the book that came from this obsession with David Starr Jordan and her search for what? For some kind of clarity, I guess, for life, which her dad had told her meant nothing. The book is called Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. What she found about David Starr Jordan was inspiring, at least at first, but some of the other stuff she learned about his life got pretty sketchy. And we won't give too much about that away today. But Lulu told us she started this interest in Jordan with just the earthquake story and not really much else.
when I first started out, I didn't even know his name. I just knew that someone responded with utter brazen resilience and stubbornness after an earthquake destroyed his life's work. That I just knew this one little detail about how he responded to destruction with innovation and with trying to find a new way to order his fish that he believed would protect them against future chaos and destruction. And I thought there was something almost comic, possibly admirable about him. But I didn't know, I didn't even know if it was a him. I assumed it was a him because it was turn of the, it was early 1900s. But I didn't even know his name. And so then I you know, I quickly learned his name. And then I could see on Google, like, I could see that he, you know, I saw very quickly that he was the first president of Stanford. Mm. I thought that was interesting. I saw that he was born in upstate New York. And I saw he had won all these awards for pacifism, that he had won all these awards for higher education, that he was responsible for discovering a lot of fish. Like, it seemed like he had fallen out of modern thought. He didn't seem like a big name these days, but it seemed like, whoa, in his day, he was really someone big. And then I saw a few hints at a darker side that I wasn't sure how seriously to take them. So I almost saw some allegations, I guess I'd call them, and a little bit of a sense that he was involved in some darker stuff. And that made me very curious, you know? So that's kind of what I saw.
But you figured at first, I think you said, oh, it's an essay. I'll write something short about him. You didn't realize it was going to occupy your life.
Oh, God, no. God, no. Like, if you had told me 10 years ago I would spend 10 years researching this random fish scientist from the 1800s, I would have called you bonkers. Like, this random old dead white guy with a walrus mustache who studied fish. I still don't even know, like, how to identify a single fish. I'm not someone who cares about fish. This was a huge accident due to the fact that he was a phenomenal writer, a fun person to study, that he left behind all this research, and that his story is so wild and almost like a thriller. Like, there were so many surprises in store, and that have ramifications today. Truly, I set out to write. I had it in my mind. It was going to be a one-page essay called Man Versus Chaos. I was going to tell his story like a parable. I wondered what became of him in the end. He took this stand against chaos. He sort of thought he could tame it, that he could protect his work from it. And I literally just wondered what becomes of a person like that. Does he end up humiliated, successful? Let's tell him as like a modern day Icarus, where we don't know. Maybe he succeeded in flying. That was the plan. And then it spiraled.
When did it spiral? Like, when was the moment when it turned, when you're like, I think I have to write a book about this guy?
So I was in between stuff for a while, for this time around 2012. And I started what I thought was the essay. And I read this honking out of print autobiography he wrote about himself. That someone recently called like the longest, most annotated personal resume. Like, it's just sort of a brag-a-thon. Anyway, but so I read his biography.
With this incredibly pretentious title too.
Yes, called Days of a Man.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that, and I started reading a few other documents about ichthyology and about the history of collecting and taxonomy in his era. And I learned this very odd scientific detail about what his work set in motion, which to me felt like a beautiful, strange, cosmic, justice-y, perfect end for the story. And so then I was like, I started writing this essay that, again, I originally thought would be a page. And then I looked up and it was 34 pages spaced, single spaced. Wow. And I thought, oh, this might, and I didn't feel done. Like, I was like, oh, wow, this might actually be like a short book, like a novella length thing. So that was it. It was after the first pulse of writing on it, which was about a 6-week period. And that's when I looked up. Yeah.
But was it the part of you that is a science reporter that made you want to write the book, or was it the personal part? Because it's so much.
Oh, it was so personal. It was so personal. It was not the science reporter part of me at all. I thought this was something that I started out in. And again, I think I wanted it to be small just because I was almost like not ashamed, but I didn't think that this was, I thought that this was a more artistic endeavor where I would read his life like a parable and maybe it could give me a little guidance, because I was in a moment in my life where I was really lost and I was in between jobs, a 7-year-long relationship had just fallen apart. I was in a new place where I didn't really have a community and I was very unsure of the path ahead. In a way, basically whether to follow passion or reason, like I, that was kind of, and so I wondered about this guy because I thought that he seemed so persistent and stubborn in the face of a world telling him to give up on his endeavor. And I wondered what becomes of you when you don't back down and when you don't take the hints that you should give up. I think it was truly from a personal, authentic curiosity of like, what was his end? And then it spiraled into something way beyond my desire to fit it into a moral parable. And that's when I sort of, I guess I would almost say like, that's when I then put my science reporter hat back on and started looking at the nuances of the story and what it told us about life that had nothing to do with my particular craving to turn him into a parable.
Let's talk about his David Starr Jordan's early life. I mean, I have to say it begins so charmingly, like the story of his life, and then it just sort of spirals into this weird place, which we'll talk a little bit about, but we won't give too much away. But so he's from a very young boy, he has this kind of exuberance about charting and categorizing and collecting, and he has these maps and he has these charts and these things that his Puritan parents don't really care that much about. But he talk a little bit about who he was when he was young, because he hangs around with this old neighbor farmer and he loves the idea of naming stuff.
He is a science nerd heartthrob. I mean, he is so bullied by the world and treated like his hobby doesn't matter, and he keeps going, and it's so beautiful to watch. Yeah, it's he was born in upstate New York. He grew up on an apple orchard in a little town called Gainesville, New York, and he was one of five, although two of his siblings would die. And he, not only did his parents kind of disdain his collecting hobby, so the first thing he wanted to do, he was infatuated with a little boy with the stars, and he wanted to learn every name, and he would creep out at night and like match what he saw in the sky to this little atlas called Geography of the Heavens that he had taken out. And then he moved on to flowers and he wanted to learn the name of every flower, and eventually that would lead him to fish. But so not only did his parents kind of disdain it, his mother at one point threw away the maps he was making, and then classmates bullied him. And his very first teaching job, he couldn't get a good job because scientists at that time, it was more encouraged to be good at, commanding a lecture hall with charm and recitations of textbooks, whereas he was more interested in actually crawling around in nature and studying the plants. And so he got this kind of so-so job teaching, and his students grabbed the pointer out of his hand and set it on fire. I mean, he was just, no one cared about this passion and told him, in fact, it was a waste of time. And that it wasn't even the right way to study the world. But he just kept going, and he loved nature. He just wanted to know the names of everything. It was almost like a tick. And his journals were filled. Getting to look at his boyhood journals was such a fun part of this. These like just inky and pencil drawing, just meticulously coloring in every petal on a plant that has like 500 petals, and he finally kind of finds his way, to this old neighbor who people called shiftless and a waster of time, who had learned the scientific name of every plant in the region. And he learns from him this important trick that would sort of guide him for much of his life, although kind of eventually he'd fail to learn, follow its lesson, but to care for the, quote, hidden and insignificant. And this idea that the best clues to nature's hidden order lie in the dandelions and the buttercups, and to not be distracted by beauty. And so he was just this, in many ways, I think of him as a naturalist, science nerd, heartthrob. He loved nature, and he was obsessive about studying it in the face of, you know, a whole society telling him that it didn't matter.
You know, what's interesting is it's like he begins with this kind of touching regard for the insignificant, and the way his life begins to, here's kind of a loaded word, evolve kind of in different ways. Like, so there's, and he meets this really important figure in his life after he graduates from college, from Cornell. He meets a man you describe as one of the most famous naturalists of the day, Louis Agassiz.
Yeah.
So talk about him, because he starts this summer camp and David ends up going there, and he's Agassiz has this idea about nature that, as you put it in the book, hiding in nature was this divine hierarchy of God's creation. So talk about this moment in David's life and what he makes of that.
This was the moment, the summer, that changed the trajectory of his life. So he's kind of faltering, and he finds his way to this cool summer camp for naturalists on an island in Cape Cod, Penakis Island, this tiny rock of an island with barely even a tree, that this famous naturalist, Louis Agassiz, Swiss naturalist, who helped, basically was one of the first to discover or propose the idea that an ice age had happened, and known for this like very charismatic teaching style. And he set up this summer camp for young naturalists to come and study. And about 50, a mix of men and women, came for a summer to learn to study nature, not books. So this was David's dream summer. And Agassiz and a bunch of other teachers instructed these students to basically, as Agassiz saw it, he believed, right, that every single species was a thought of God, and to put them in their proper order would be eventually to discover the divine plan, literally the sort of path to ascension. And therefore, he called looking at nature, this thing that had been written off as shameful and wasteful, he called it missionary work of the highest order. So he believed this was the path to true insights and progress that could keep, that could get us out of, you know, a sort of trapped state. And at that point, you know, there were, like, at that point, people didn't even, you know that bacteria was the cause of disease. There were things, there was really something to this idea of studying nature directly. And so this idea that there's a hierarchy waiting in nature, that by putting creatures in their proper order, you could discern what God valued more. Like, for example, one part I really liked in Agassiz, or stuck with me in Agassiz's writing, was a parrot, a songbird, or an ostrich higher in the hierarchy. And if you could figure that out, then you would know which God valued more, song, size, or speech. And so things like that. And the work of figuring it out was the work of direct observation, of looking under the skin and seeing the organs and the bones and who was most closely related to whom.
So he's trying to figure out the intent of God, basically.
Yes, like literally by looking at like the guts and gristle. And that idea really changed David's life. It gave him, I think, this sense of purpose that buoyed him, and he emerges from that camp with like this new, you know, purpose attached to passion. It just made him unstoppable, and he suddenly gets a great job. He gets promoted at Indiana University. He's teaching natural sciences. He gets promoted within a few years to be the president, and he's the youngest president in the entire country, youngest academic university president in the entire country at that time. He was in his mid-30s. And he just gets, and then he gets, he's going on all these fish collecting expeditions. He's discovering more and more fish. And then the Stanfords, Leland and Jane Stanford, who are starting up Stanford University, they're looking around for a president, and they go out to Bloomington, Indiana, and they poach him. They're like, come work for us, be our first president. And so he just, I think that that sense of purpose in what he's doing, it just, you see this faltering life suddenly take a huge leap after he meets Agassi and is told that what he's doing matters. And so that a sense of a hierarchy that then fueled his work for a long time, even when shortly after The Island, he did accept the ideas of Darwin. Darwin was becoming increasingly popular. And, you know, he originally published in 1859, and now it had been over 10 years. And so David Starr Jordan eventually accepted Darwinism, even though his prophet, as I call him, Agassi, didn't. Agassi remained a opponent of, refuted, you know, just did not accept Darwinism until his dying day. But David did. And he, yeah. So then he kind of left room for this idea that there was a hierarchy in nature that had been carved out by time, not God.
And this is when you, this is like, this seems like this is when you kind of fell for him. Because, like, yeah. David, right? Because he says this thing that you, it's a line that said made you adore him. Here it is. I went over to the evolutionist. So he's not sure he's convinced about Darwin, but then he gets converted. And he writes, mm-hmm. I went over to the evolutionists with the grace of a cat the boy leads by its tail across the carpet.
That's it. Yeah, that you're right. That is when I fell for David Starr Jordan. I was, because I realized, I watched him, you know, he's dragged. He doesn't want to go, but he's dragged by his tail across the carpet and he becomes an evolutionist. And he still goes on. And the moment, you know, where he's just defying chaos comes way later. So that's what that said to me was, however this guy is brewing his faith still comes from a worldview that I share,
yeah.
where, you know, where it's about evolution and accidents and randomness and chaos. So he's got some trick. He's got some way of persevering that I don't think is about faith. And that's, again, what I was looking for is, like, how do we move forward on dark days if we don't have faith? How do you brew faith without faith, capital F?
Yeah.
And so reading that line made me think, okay, he still may have something for me. Like, he may have something. And yeah, I was reading that line. I just, like, I remember it. I just warmed. I was like, okay, I can keep following this guy.
Lulu Miller. Her new book is called Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is an essential resource in your daily life. We're giving you reliable information about the coronavirus so you can make smart decisions for yourself, your family, and your community. You're an essential part of KUER's daily life, too. Our contributing listeners provide the largest share of our funding, money that fuels our editorial independence. You're going to continue to count on KUER. We're hoping we can count on you. Give at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the science reporter, co-creator of the podcast Invisibilia, is with us, talking about her book, Why Fish Don't Exist, which is kind of a memoir, but one that weaves into her own story, the fascinating story of this scientist named David Starr Jordan. Lulu, she grew up without faith. Her father was dogmatically atheist and was constantly reminding her about the meaninglessness of life. And when she first learned about Jordan, who himself ditched religion early in his life, she saw someone who managed to have faith in life without faith in God. And the story that she first heard about Jordan, the story that revealed that for her, happened in 1906.
He's been at Stanford at this point for about 15 years, and he's, you know, he's had all this access to kind of bottomless amount of money. He's hired a bunch of his friends to work in the biology department. He's commissioned expeditions all over the world, the Galapagos, Russia, Panama, like Hawaii, everywhere. He's collected fish from tons of places. He's discovered hundreds of new species. And he's got everything arranged in these just kind of higher and higher on the shelves, where there's a fish in a little bit of ethanol, preserving alcohol, and then there'll be like a tin name tag with its species name on it. And he had so many fish species that some of them weren't even identified yet. So they were unknown creatures that didn't yet have their names, but were awaiting the sacred moment of identification. About 5 in the morning, there is just this huge earthquake. Thousands of people are eventually killed in San Francisco as a result of the crumbling buildings and fire. He wakes up in his bed. It feels like he's being shaken around like a rat being shaken by a dog. He's got a son sleeping down the hall, and another son was weirdly sleeping on the roof that night. So he runs to get his little son, Eric, and they eventually get outside. And the son who had been on the roof said he watched the whole campus basically fall down like a house of cards. David realizes, you know, he's the president. He's got to go see how everything's doing. And he runs over, and the welcome arch is literally crumbled. The new gymnasium is crumbled. There are people trapped under fallen stone. 2 people on campus die. And he runs to his lab. Utter carnage. There's broken glass. There are fish thrown all over the lab, starting to dry out. The names are scattered at random. All his work, it's like in a few seconds, just ripped away. It felt almost biblical to me. It was like Genesis in reverse. All these creatures had instantaneously become the unknown again. And then he looks out the window, and in front of his lab, he and the Stanfords had erected this huge statue of Agassiz out front. And Agassiz is literally thrown headfirst into the pavement. And there's photographs of this. His feet are upright. And to me, it's like there is no clearer message. Like, the names are ripped off. Your prophet is defiled. Chaos reigns. That's sort of when David just immediately begins scrambling around. And there's just something so, like, to me, desperate and kind of beautiful and human about that, of just, he has no idea how he's going to fix it or if he'll be able to re-identify these creatures, because now they don't have any context. We don't know where they came from. They're just unknown flesh on the floor. But he doesn't give up. The first thing he does is, all right, let's keep them wet. It's like existential triage. And so, yeah, time moves on and the sun rises and falls, and these 2 guys just stand there with hoses aimed at the fish. And then eventually ethanol comes and he gets them less vulnerable to decay. And then he begins this grueling task of trying to re-identify them. And there's a bunch he can't and he has to throw away. And there are likely fish species on that floor that were never rediscovered again, that we just lost. But for the ones he can identify, he begins this new process. And this was the moment that drew me in, of sewing the name tag directly to the flesh. So that should an earthquake come again, you know, the jars may fall, but man's knowledge will not be separated from nature. It felt like Odysseus driving the stake through the Cyclops, like just taking this tiny little weapon, a sewing needle, and believing that could somehow tame chaos or keep it at bay. And it was both beautiful, but I wondered if it was foolish. But yeah, that's the moment. That's the moment that drew me into this whole mess.
Lulu Miller's book is called Why Fish Don't Exist: A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. So you're trying to figure out, like, what's the secret formula for his faith? How does he manage knowing that the universe is built on chaos? How does he manage to persevere? Talk about how you start to figure it out. Because he has what the – he develops this thing called – what he called the shield of optimism. And it gets us to this idea of self-delusion that you work through in the book. Talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of start to wonder, like, okay, this guy writes all – you know, he writes his autobiography. He writes children's books. He writes poems. He writes satires. Like, he writes a lot. And so I wondered if he had something to say about this persistence and how he's able to go on a really dark day where it feels like what you're doing is profoundly futile. How does he go on? And so I started just like reading everything he'd written, looking for clues. And basically a few things emerge. And one of the main ones is that he says he's just kind of always had what he calls the shield of optimism and this sense that like, people even remarked on it, just that criticism and rejection never seemed to bother him. And he's always kind of, one colleague said, he's always a humming, a tune, a down the arcade, no matter how bad the day. So yeah. I think part of that was just innate. Like he just came out sunny. He just came out uncrumplable. But he prided himself on not having self-delusion. He, in many ways, he writes again and again, warning against magical thinking and, you know, just saying again and again that the work of a good scientist is to constantly acknowledge your cosmic impotence. So he seems to pride himself on an accurate worldview. But finally, I kind of found this one passage in his writing that I think to me showed that actually on the bad days he did carry some self-delusion to get up and going. And that was in this kind of essay he wrote just a few days after the earthquake. And he has this line where he basically says that, you know, he's never seen so much devastation, but he has faith that humans, man, as he called them, will rise again. And he writes, "It is the will of man that shapes the fates." And it's this kind of rousing passage that to me defies everything else he's written about. Like if you look at his work, this sentence is so aberrant because he has these other tirades saying that anyone who believes he can control the fates is vainly beating the air. You know, but in this moment of desperation, he believes this idea that we can shape the fates. A man who usually believes that it is your job to be humble and admit that the fates shape you. So the fates being kind of chaos. But so that to me stuck out as like, oh, on your bad days, as much as you rail against it, you actually do need to believe that humans are way more powerful than they are. And so that kind of opened the door to me to suddenly putting my own morality on the shelf and saying, well, like, what do the experts say about self-delusion? And is it always a path to danger or humiliation or evil? And so there's a whole chapter in the book where I just look at what psychologists have said about self-delusion. And, you know, spoiler alert, about 50 years of research shows that in moderation, self-delusion is really powerful and helpful and can keep us healthy. Which, you know, maybe you've heard that, and I think in certain ways I had too, but really looking that in the face and seeing even how that's changing slowly what goes on in the therapist's office, how maybe the goal of therapy isn't necessarily to help you gain insight, but it's to help you have a slightly deluded sense of yourself to at least just have some chance against all the bad luck ahead. You know, that I'm still reckoning with, yeah.
How do you explain that? I mean, it's one of the you say that it kind of gets us to this idea that you explore in that chapter about, you know, that the, I don't know, it was kind of the buzzword for a while, still maybe is, you know, the trend about grit, that the as you put it in the book, the cognitive glitch that gets you grit are these positive illusions that you create for yourself. And the question is this healthy? Is this good? And it seems like it used to be thought of that, no, of course, self-delusion is a terrible thing. But in some ways, like maybe it is, maybe it's a really good thing in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, the way I think that I'm thinking about it these days is just that in certain ways, like it has been shown time and time again that a little bit of positive illusion. And again, the psychologists who study this are very clear. Tons of delusion is maladaptive and is going to hurt you if you're, if you become a narcissist, there's a social toll. And if you're utterly deluded about what you can do, you know, so we're just talking a sprinkle here. But yeah, I do think, I mean, the main thing I'm thinking about is, sure, it has showed that it will help you achieve your goals. It'll help you get the girl or the job or the promotion, you know, or win the race. It helps. The effect is measurable. But what about other people's goals? And for me, the question is, like, how does that interact with reality? And if this is a trait that just turns you a little bit more into a bulldozer, what about the effect on others? And I think a lot of, you know, books have been written about how to achieve grit and how to succeed. And, you know, people are in awe of what it can do for you. And I think maybe I'm, you know, old fashioned and overly moralistic in my weird heathen way. But like, I do worry about just the toll on others. Mm. And aren't there goals that matter besides our own? But at the same time, if you're using it to, like, if you're using it for good, I mean, how else does an activist, how else is social change created? Like, you need grit in a society that's telling you don't matter day in and day out to keep saying you do. Black Lives Matter. Like, that you need. So, like, this stubbornness, I think, can be used for incredible good. And I guess it's just, it just feels like it's like a, with great power comes great responsibility. And I think for, on the personal level, it's beautiful to just say, hey, maybe I can lie to myself a little or ignore some of these failures or rejections and just keep going. And it's nice to know that isn't necessarily going to lead you into humiliation. Actually, it might help you. But I think it's also like, do some reality testing and also consider what that stubbornness, what effect is it having on the people around you? So that's kind of how I've come to think about it.
People who have this grandiose view of themselves can strike out, can be aggressive. And this starts to get us to a darker side of David Starr Jordan. Would you talk about this sort of turn, this twist?
Yeah. So you don't necessarily always see it in his own writings because personally, slightly deluded person that he is, he's going to always do a sunny side of himself. But the more I started to look at what other people were saying about him and little bits of a paper trail that remained on his presidency and his personal life, there was quite a pattern of mercilessly bulldozing anyone who got in his way, you know, getting people fired, threatening them with allegations about their sexuality, just all kinds of stuff, just happily making up rumors about them and writing them to powerful people who might employ them in the future. I mean, he was just shameless about that stuff for the people that got in his way. And that's just the paper trail that remains. So then I think, what didn't remain, you know, whose story didn't get caught? And it goes so far, I don't want to give too much away, but it goes so far as to him being involved, potentially really involved in basically something incredibly dark and unexpected at the personal level. And then also at the policy level. So there were, his involvement in two separate things, that I think was related to this trait of just bulldozing positive illusion, being sure of yourself, being sure your ideas are right, really led him to just be able to perpetrate like an unthinkable breadth of violence.
When you started to realize the, I have to say, just kind of stunning remorselessness.
Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned in the book how that just, it was, I think you describe it as chilling, and it just made you like sick.
Yeah.
Talk about when that it occurs to you that this guy that you had faith in at first to help you sort of work through your own questions about chaos without having to rely on something divine or a god or something like that. Like, he's the guy. He's going to help me through this. And then you learn this really terrible stuff.
Yeah.
How did you react to that?
Well, I just thought, is this, you know, like, is this who I want to emulate? I mean, it was, yeah, it was chilling. It was disgusting. Like, that moment of wanting to, that you shared with the, you know, that we talked about with the being dragged across the carpet like a cat. Mm-hmm. In that moment, I wanted to throw my arms around him. I felt so much affection and admiration. And then this was its polar opposite. I wanted to throw my hands off him. I just, again, I'd heard sort of insinuation. So my ears were pricked of like, is there darkness here? But then the extent to it and the amount he wasn't just involved in some horrific policies, but one of the earliest and loudest proponents and someone who would not hear the opposition, and how remorseless he was. Just, and maybe he wasn't privately, but I could not find a paper trail of any remorse. If anything, he just dug into his certainty and shut out the world. And that was really, yeah, it was just disgust. Like, I thought, wow, there are lessons to learn here. And he was successful. I mean, that's kind of like, what do you do with this? It's like, this works, but do you want to emulate this kind of person? And it left me, I think it left me disgusted and confused. yeah. And I think in a way, I honestly don't think I came out with a clear, are you a cautionary tale or a hero? I think the truth is that I came out with him offering both. I think I came out with this idea that positive illusion can really help you, and this is concrete and powerful, and maybe it's okay to dabble in it a little more. But the bigger lesson for me was like, actually about the gifts of uncertainty, and about the more he held on to his beliefs, to me is where I see the evil really starting to take place. Because we all make mistakes. I mean, no one's going to live a perfect life. But for me, I see the descent correlate with the tighter and tighter grip on his certainty and the deafening out, you know, the not listening to the voices of opposition. And so for me, the bigger lesson is like, don't ever get too certain and be open to revision and listen. And it's not always easy. We're all living in uncertainty right now, and it's horrible. But trying to retrain myself to stay open in uncertainty and to see the benefits of uncertainty, like that to me is the deeper lesson. And that's actually the path to the gifts of life.
Him having no doubt, and then him seeing that there is some hierarchical, there's some moral hierarchy in the universe.
Yeah.
This was amounted to something like, and maybe I'm overstating it, but it seemed like an epiphany for him, that this is how you say in the book, that offered him, as you put it in the book, that lovely, warm feeling of significance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, in a weird way, I think I actually held some of his beliefs going in about time forging a hierarchy. Like, I think I was like, I understood, you know, my dad was obviously explaining evolution at age 3 to us, but like, I think I did believe that time sharpened creatures toward better. But so I think I had like a loose belief in the hierarchy myself, going into just like an intuitive sense that humans are better than birds, and birds are kind of cool, but they have bird brains and they're small and they can fly, and mushrooms are really low. You know, like, I think I had that sense, and looking really deeply at what taxonomists, modern taxonomists, believe about how life is connected, and understanding even simpler ideas that like newer doesn't mean better. I mean, there's all kinds of creatures that are newer than us that we don't suddenly anoint as our superiors. You know, there are just things like that. I think my epiphany with this book has been challenging myself to really let go of the hierarchy. It's like the reverse epiphany of what he got on Penicuese Island.
That was sort of the moment when you, not to give too much away, but it's sort of alluded to in the title. That's kind of when you gave up the fish, I guess.
Yeah. There were kind of these like larger scientific ideas that I encountered early on in writing about him that took me years of talking to scientists and thinking on my own, just going on runs and noticing the world and trying to draw charts of how things are linked. And just this slow, like it just felt like an unscrunching or an unscrewing of my own logic, or a lens with which I usually see nature, like it, this slow kind of process where I finally began to let go of certain hierarchies in the natural world, which I think especially matters, to question those hierarchies we also have about the human world, and just little slips of judgment we're making all the time, whether it even be right now, like who deserves a ventilator and what life do we value more, and how are those decisions being made with lots of arguing and foresight, or are they just soberly pronounced as state policy? Which is really scary, because I think in those sober predicaments, in that sober sort of policy where we say maybe someone who's older or someone who's disabled is lower in the chain of deserving a ventilator, like that is a hierarchy you're making and not even questioning. And the assumption there is that like a disabled life doesn't matter as much, which is so messed up. I think that's kind of the work I'll be doing for the rest of my life, and I find thrilling and important, of just like what little hierarchies are still in place and being enforced, and what assumptions do we need to kick at and look at more closely.
Let me ask you this finally, I guess sort of coming back around to something you were mentioning before, whatever lesson from the last 10 years you're taking for these moments of self-isolation right now. Like you were looking for this kind of clarity, but that's not what you got. And I guess that's sort of where we are now. This is maybe helping you cope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what am I thinking about now? I mean, honestly, the weird plot twist for me is that I'm actually thinking about how David Starr Jordan would approach this moment. And I know, like, for all his evil, that man would be creative right now. That man would not sit around bemoaning what was robbed of him, or what plans were foiled, or what work he lost, as many of us, I think, did, especially in the first few weeks of this, the disbelief. He would look at the moment, the isolation, and he would just take it as a creative constraint, and he would just invent something new. Like, he would invent a new way to connect. He would invent a new way to hunt fish. Like, he would just innovate right now. And so I do think, as much as he turns into someone I'd never want to be like, I do think that is still a concrete, useful thing to be thinking about, of, you know, how do we use that human ingenuity in this moment to, like, you know, I think it's David Foster Wallace who talks about, many people talk about it, but that he famously talked about, you know, how we use our attention, like that is the most precious and important choice. And do we stand in the grocery line being irritated that we picked the slow one, or do we stand in the grocery line dazzling over the cool design on the gum wrapper, you know? And that's like this moment, I think, is like, do we train our brain, you know, the precious electricity of our brain, do we spend that on contemplating everything we've lost and considering the contours and what could have been, or do we look to the future? And again, I'm not talking about people who've lost someone. I think grief has to happen, but I think there's a lesson to be learned. I don't know. That's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking weirdly about how to be more like him, which I did not see coming.
Lulu Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and talking about this hard to talk about book. I've really enjoyed it.
That's Lulu Miller. She's co-founder of the NPR podcast Invisibilia. Her book is Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tue, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.